Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The European Union is struggling to deal with a chaotic flood of migrants. Turkey, which is home to more refugees than any other country in the world, is blaming EU leaders for the chaos and says European nations ignored repeated warnings. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
With much of the world shocked by the image of a drowned Syrian toddler on a Turkish beach, the latest victim among refugees seeking to enter the European Union, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan Thursday accused European countries of turning the Mediterranean Sea into a grave. Ahmet İçdoğru, an expert on migration for Istanbul's Koç University, says there is deep resentment in Ankara.
Why the European countries are having less concern about the Syrian refugee problem? Unfortunately, it's the case almost around the world. Of course, everyone tried to shift the responsibility to other side.
Ankara says Turkey's hosting over 2 million Iraqi and Syrian refugees. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Syria's antiquities chief says Islamic State militants have destroyed three ancient tower tombs in the central city of Palmyra, continuing efforts to demolish a World Heritage Site. Mahmoud Abdulkarim said Friday the militants destroyed the three famed tower tombs in recent days, including the Tower of Ilabel that dates back to the year 103 AD. This marks one of a series of deliberate vandalism acts carried out by Islamic State since it captured Palmyra in May. Earlier this week, the head of the UN Cultural Agency, UNESCO, called the destruction of Palmyra an intolerable crime against civilization. This is VOA News. U.S. President Barack Obama welcomed Saudi King Salman to the White House Friday for the Arab leader's first visit to the United States since ascending the throne in January following the death of King Abdullah. The talks between President Obama and the king could not come at a more tumultuous time as a U.S.-led coalition fights Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria, and a Saudi-led coalition beats back Iranian-supported Houthi rebels in Yemen. Friday's meeting at the White House will be the first since a May 14th summit, during which President Obama spent time with Gulf Cooperation Council leaders, assuaging any concerns about brokering a nuclear agreement with Iran. The U.S. unemployment rate fell to the lowest level in 7.5 years in August, 5.1%. That is a drop of 0.2% from the previous month. Friday's report from the Labor Department also says the economy had a net gain of 173,000 jobs, which is less than most economists had predicted. The report says the healthcare and financial services sectors gained jobs, while mining and manufacturing lost positions. This report is a key part of the data that leaders of the U.S. Central Bank will consider as they decide how soon and how much to raise the benchmark interest rate. PNC Bank analysts call this a strong report on the U.S. labor market, but adds that the Fed's decision on interest rates will be made at the last moment. A gay couple in Kentucky has received a marriage license a day after a county clerk was jailed for refusing to license same-sex couples. The county clerk, Kim Davis, had defied a U.S. Supreme Court order to sign the marriage permits, saying it violated her religious beliefs. Federal judge ordered her to jail for contempt of court and said she could be freed if she agrees to approve the licenses. Speaking in court, Davis occasionally sobbed as she told the judge that, quote, God's moral law conflicts with my job duties. You can't be separated for something that's in your heart and in your soul, end quote. Two senior members of Ukraine's far-right Svoboda Party were charged Friday with rioting after being questioned in Kiev in connection with Monday's clashes outside Parliament. Three National Guard officers died of injuries from a grenade explosion during clashes between police and nationalists protesting a constitutional amendment granting more powers to Ukrainian regions, including the rebel-held East. More than 140 people were hospitalized. One officer remains in a coma. Free college tuition, doubling the minimum wage, a single-payer universal health care system. Those are just a few of the campaign promises by Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, who does not try to hide that he embraces a form of socialism. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehizu Heben. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
the UN Refugee Agency is calling for a common effort by all 28 European Union countries to address in a humane and fair manner the biggest refugee influx into Europe in decades. The UNHCR warns as many as 200,000 more refugees, most from Syria, are likely to make the dangerous journey to Europe in search of asylum this year.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Turkey blames the European Union for the chaos over migration. Analysts debate how Boko Haram can continue attacks while holding no territory. And Kenyan politicians disagree over how to handle the International Criminal Court.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Nigeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the UN Refugee Agency is calling for a common effort by all 28 European Union countries to address in a humane and fair manner the biggest refugee influx into Europe in decades. The UNHCR warns as many as 200,000 more refugees, most from Syria, are likely to make the dangerous journey to Europe in search of asylum this year. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Figures from UN agencies show a dramatic escalation in the number of refugees coming to Europe in recent days. The UN Refugee Agency reports 5,600 refugees arrived in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia on Thursday, the highest number for one single day, and it says 3,300 arrived in Hungary that day. More than 300,000 people have risked their lives to cross the Mediterranean Sea this year, according to the UNHCR. More than 2,600 did not survive. More than 4 million Syrian refugees have sought asylum in neighboring countries. UNHCR spokeswoman Melissa Fleming says conditions in these countries are worsening. People are living in abject poverty. They see no end to the conflict.
They're losing hope to be able to go home. They have no ability to restart their life in the neighboring countries in any meaningful way. Many are making the decision now to go to Europe.
Fleming says Europe can no longer respond to this crisis in a piecemeal way and that a common strategy is needed. She says no country can address this emergency alone or refuse to do its part. She tells VOA the UNHCR is proposing that large reception centers be set up in Greece, Italy, and Hungary where people could be registered and have their asylum claims processed quickly. She says these centers would be run by the European Union with the support of the UNHCR and the International Organization for Migration. The refugees pay large sums of money to traffickers and smugglers in their desperation to reach Europe. The UNHCR says governments in Europe and other regions must protect the refugees by offering them ways to enter their countries legally. The agency says governments should consider larger resettlement and humanitarian admission quotas, expanded visa and sponsorship programs, and scholarships to students. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The International Office for Migration says an estimated 50 migrants are missing today and believed drowned off the coast of Libya. Reuters news agency says they were passengers in a large inflated boat that was slowly deflating. Another 91 on board were rescued. Of more than 364,000 migrants who have tried to cross the Mediterranean this year, about 2,700 have drowned. For months, politically divided Libya has been the center of human trafficking across the Mediterranean to Europe. One of two governments vying for control of Libya has asked the European Union and the Arab League for aid in controlling the smuggling. The request came from a government established in Tripoli last year, where militias bombed the airport and overrun government facilities. Most of the international community and many rival members of parliament evacuated the capital. The rival administration was set up in Tobruk to the east. During months of negotiations, the UN has not been able to bring the two governments together.
The European Union is struggling to deal with a chaotic flood of migrants. Turkey, which is home to more refugees than any other country in the world, is blaming EU leaders for the chaos and says European nations ignored repeated warnings. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
With much of the world shocked by the image of a drowned Syrian toddler on a Turkish beach, the latest victim among refugees seeking to enter the European Union, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan Thursday accused European countries of turning the Mediterranean Sea into a grave. Ahmet İştoğlu, an expert on migration for Istanbul's Koç University, says there is deep resentment in Ankara that the EU had ignored its warnings and calls for help over the mounting refugee crisis.
Why the European countries are having less concern about the Syrian refugee problem? Unfortunately, it's the case almost around the world. Of course, everyone tried to shift the responsibility to other side. We should not forget that still European countries observing those migrants in terms of their economies. Also, there's an economic crisis in Europe.
Ankara says Turkey's hosting over 2 million Iraqi and Syrian refugees at a cost of over $6 billion. President Erdogan has repeatedly criticized Brussels for failing to share fairly the burden of refugees or the cost, a point he reportedly made during a telephone conversation with his French counterpart François Hollande Thursday. But political scientist Cengiz Aktar of Istanbul's Süleyman Şah University says some of the blame lies with Ankara.
International organizations, big NGOs, they were all ready to come and help. But Turkey said, no, no, I can do it myself. Now they are stuck.
With the refugee crisis now reaching EU countries, there is hope in Ankara that Brussels is finally addressing the growing crisis, says political columnist Semih Yediz of Turkey's Cumhuriyet newspaper and Al Monitor website.
It's already hard-pressed to meet the requirements of these refugees. They're spread across the country. This is also causing social problems within Turkey between communities.
With the Syrian conflict showing no signs of ending soon, observers say Ankara will be hoping that finally the international community will start to share fairly the burden of the refugee crisis. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Mihi Suhib, 13 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Turkey blames the European Union for the chaos over migration. Analysts debate how Boko Haram can continue attacks while holding no territory in Nigeria. And Kenyan politicians disagree over how to handle the International Criminal Court. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The extremist group Boko Haram continues to kill hundreds of people each month with attacks across northeastern Nigeria. At the same time, analysts say it's hard to tell where the fighters are based, as the group appears to control little or no territory. Chris Stein has more from Lagos.
The Nigerian army announced this week that it had recaptured the town of Gamboro in Gala along the Cameroonian border from Boko Haram. What remains unclear is at what point they lost control of it. The town was occupied by Boko Haram early this year, but retaken during a multi-nation offensive that resulted in the militants losing most of the territory they had seized. At some point after, Boko Haram overran Gamboro again. Rabe Abubakar is a spokesman for Nigeria's military.
They were there, you know, for some months before this latest success against them.
Abubakar says Boko Haram doesn't control any other towns in Nigeria. But as this week's battle in Gamboro and Gala shows, the group remains far from finished. The governors of Borno and Yobe states in the northeast said in July that the militants still controlled five local government areas in their states, and they're still raiding remote villages, killing hundreds of people each month. President Muhammadu Buhari last month gave Nigeria's top military commanders 3 months to defeat Boko Haram. Michael Klein, senior analyst at Drum Cusack, says that's put the military under pressure to announce successes against the group.
We may well continue to see reports that the military has, quote, retaken territory from Boko Haram, territory that we didn't know was being held to begin with.
Despite battlefield losses earlier this year, Boko Haram maintains a large fighting force that's able to hide along Nigeria's northeast border, Klein says. That will prove a challenge for the military.
So it might just become a game of whack the mole, where you route out fighters from a certain area only to have them end up in another place.
Troops from Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Benin are supposed to soon join Nigeria in fighting the group. But Klein says it will take years of development and job creation in the Northeast to end the insurgency for good. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Despite the availability of a rapid diagnostic test for malaria, many Nigerian health workers fail or refuse to use it. A new study says this can lead to misdiagnosis and a waste of expensive malaria drugs. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports.
Much progress has been made against malaria. The World Health Organization says mortality rates have fallen 47% between 2000 and 2013. But many millions of people are still at risk or are infected. And malaria remains a major killer of young children. The WHO says more than 430,000 kids die from malaria in Africa every year. One estimate from the NGO Malaria No More says Nigeria, with 48 million cases, represents one quarter of Africa's malaria burden. There are generally two ways to diagnose malaria. The first is microscopy, where a trained staff at a lab looks for parasites in a blood sample. The second method is a rapid diagnostic test. It's quick, 15 to 30 minutes, and just requires a finger prick of blood. It does not require a lab and allows for diagnosis at the community level. The test looks for specific proteins that malaria parasites produce. The problem is, many Nigerian health workers or drug providers are not using either test. University of Nigeria professor Obinna Amujekwe is the lead author of the study that appeared in the scientific journal PLOS ONE.
There are very few instances where there's proper diagnosis for malaria. Most people wrongly assume that all fevers are malaria. So once you have a fever, you're most likely to get a malaria drug without diagnosis. That is wrong. Not all fevers are malaria.
About 5,000 people from 40 communities took part in the study in Enugu State in southeastern Nigeria. Despite being trained in using the rapid diagnostic test, rates of actually administering it were less than 50%.
Because of that, there's a lot of waste. Drugs are wasted, quite a lot of money, especially now that the first-line drugs are the expensive artemisinin-based combination therapy.
China and Vietnam grow most of the plants artemisinin is derived from, but there's a growing market in East Africa. Despite negotiations to lower prices, the first-line drugs remain more expensive than other less effective treatments. Professor Anwujekwe says the study examined why the rapid malaria test was not being used by many health workers or private drug sellers. But in many cases, the health workers were the drug sellers.
The drug sellers who are private, I think their main purpose is profit. They want to make money. I mean, if somebody comes with fever and they say, oh, go home, nothing for you, well, they lose money, number one.
And number two, he says, is those patients will simply go to another drug seller who is willing to give them artemisinin-based medicine without a reliable malaria diagnosis. Anwujekwe says another problem is many health workers don't trust the rapid diagnostic test. They would rather diagnose someone strictly on their symptoms.
If the test says it's not malaria, they didn't believe the test.
So what happens when people are misdiagnosed and given the wrong treatment?
Oh, there's so many consequences. That other illness can cause real damage, which may even lead to death. That's one. Then the high economic cost to the society, and then wasting the drugs. Then number three, it can be development of resistance to malaria parasites if the drugs are not used properly.
The study says training health workers on new procedures is not enough. It calls for ongoing engagement with them by malaria control programs, which include the government, NGOs, and UN agencies, to change the old mindset about how to diagnose patients. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Joe. Well, tension is brewing in Kenya's ruling coalition between allies of Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and backers of his deputy, William Ruto. Ruto's allies say the government is not supporting their man at the International Criminal Court, where he is on trial for alleged crimes against humanity. Mohammed Yusuf has the story from Nairobi.
Kenyan media outlets report that political leaders from the Rift Valley region will hold a meeting this weekend to pray for their leader, Deputy President William Ruto. Some observers say the gathering will really focus on the fallout from the ICC's latest ruling in the Ruto case. Judges ruled that last month prosecutors can use statements from witnesses who later recanted their testimonies. The ruling caused pale trouble for Ruto, who critics have accused of witness tampering. It could also cause rifts in the ruling Jubilee coalition. Supporters of Ruto say the government has failed to support the deputy president in his fight to avoid conviction. Kenyan political writer Barak Muluka tells VOA that meetings like the one this weekend will create tension among the different ethnic groups in the Rift Valley.
These rumblings do spell some cause for concern among such persons, because if they're saying that our person has been left out, remember that the possession here, when we say our person, it's something that boils down to ethnic definitions of who we are, who then this our person is, and who we think has abandoned him. And that definitely would not augur so well for those places.
President Kenyatta and Ruto were both accused of helping to organize post-election violence 7 years ago. That killed more than 1,100 people and displaced 600,000 from their homes. Both men denied the charges. Back then, the two leaders were on opposite sides of the fighting, but they came together ahead of 2013 presidential elections, issuing a joint call to reject the ICC as part of their campaign. Last December, the International Criminal Court prosecutor withdrew charges against Kenyatta, citing a lack of evidence. Muluka says if Ruto is found guilty, it is going to put the president and the country in a difficult situation.
If I hand him over, opens up the floodgates of problems with the people who are sitting with him in the Jubilee Alliance from the Kalenjin community. He doesn't hand him over, that makes him a pariah, president superintending over a pariah state. So he is squarely cast between a rock and a hard place.
Kenya's Attorney General told the Daily Nation newspaper the state is doing everything it can to help the deputy president. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
In Sierra Leone, military and police are being rushed to a village in Cambia district to prevent a possible new outbreak of the Ebola virus disease. The three-week quarantine will affect an estimated 1,000 residents of the Sela Kafta village where the virus has been detected. Officials have announced the quarantine where a 67-year-old trader who died had tested positive for the virus. The quarantine will restrict all residents to their own homes. World Health officials announced earlier this week that they will vaccinate about 200 residents who may have had contact with the trader. Sela Kafta is near the border with Guinea. The discovery of the virus set back efforts to end an 18-month epidemic that has infected more than 28,000 people in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and killed more than a third of them. In other news, officials at a hospital in Kinema have announced that a newborn baby that has become a symbol of recovery from the West African epidemic died Wednesday. Baby Barnabas was born August 9th to the first person to recover from the virus in Sierra Leone. He was buried yesterday. A hospital nurse said he died of an infection that is not related to the virus. When the 21-year mother, Victoria Yilia, was declared free of the virus, the government declared National Survivors Day. Yilia had lost 21 of her relatives to the virus.
South Sudan rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar say they are committed to the implementation of the peace deal signed last month in Addis Ababa. This came as a three-day workshop on transitional security arrangements in South Sudan gets underway tomorrow in Addis Ababa. Ambassador Ezekiel Lol Gatkuth, the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the Sudan People's Liberation Army, SPLA, said the rebels are committed to a peaceful and democratic South Sudan and have selected a team of officers to attend the security arrangements workshop. We are committed to this peace, and we have selected 11 senior army officers to attend this workshop in Addis Ababa on the 5th of September to the 8th of September, he said. Gatkuth said the rebels are happy and appreciative of President Salva Kiir for finally signing the agreement. He said rebel leader Machar signed the deal first because he believes it is the best workable agreement. This is the best compromise that we can use to transform South Sudan. It is workable, it is implementable, the letter is there, and we are asking for the spirit, because you can have a very good agreement, but if the spirit is not there, it will not work, Gatkuth said.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
A message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year, but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. Empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all. on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Coming up, music from Nigeria. And in our feature segment, South Sudan police officers attending workshops to better understand the importance of freedom of speech and protection for journalists. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with the All-Africa Games.
Kim, the 2015 All-Africa Games are underway in Brazzaville, the capital of the Republic of the Congo, where the multi-sports competition was first held 50 years ago. The opening ceremony is Friday at the new Kintele Stadium in Brazzaville, but preliminary play has already begun in certain sports. More than 50 African countries are expected to be represented at the 11th All-Africa Games. There's competition scheduled in more than 20 sports, including athletics, badminton, basketball, football, karate, tennis, and wrestling. The South African team dominated the last All-Africa Games, held in 2011 in Maputo, Mozambique. The South Africans won 156 total medals, 58 more than second-place Nigeria. South Africa's 61 gold medals were also far and away the highest total, with Egypt next at 32. In fact, in terms of gold medals won, either South Africa or Egypt has finished on top of the medals table at each of the past seven editions of the All-Africa Games. The Egyptians, though, will be without a couple of medal-contending squads at the 2015 All-Africa Games. Egypt withdrew both its men's and women's football teams ahead of the Games, which will go through September 18th. Now let's go to Zurich, Switzerland, where African athletes sparkled at the IAAF Diamond League meet. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma reports.
Ethiopian Almaz Ayana clocked 8 minutes and 22.34 seconds to triumph in women's 3,000 meters at the IAAF Diamond League in Zurich, Switzerland on Thursday. Kenyans Asbel Kiprop, Paul Kipsiele Koech, and Eunice Sum won men's 1,500 meters, 3,000 meters steeplechase, and women's 800 meters respectively, while Algerian Taufik Makloufi and Nigerian Blessing Okagbare placed second in men's 800 meters and women's 100 meters respectively. South Africans Anaso Jobodwana and Wade Fanny Kirk were third in 200 meters and 400 meters, respectively. I'm Mark Ouma, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
Thanks, Mark. And you have a sporty weekend, too. Mark mentioned Asbel Kiprop in his report. Kiprop was one of seven Kenyans to win gold medals at the recent World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China. The Kenyan team made history in Beijing, becoming the first African country to top the medals table. In this encore Sunny Side of Sports presentation, let's listen in again to this report from the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot on the spot at Ayemi.
Good evening, Africa. Kenya has made history by becoming the first African nation to emerge the overall winner of the two yearly World Athletics Championships. The East African nation finished on top of the medals table at the 15th edition of the championships. Kenya won a total of 7 gold, 6 silver, and 3 bronze medals to finish ahead of Jamaica with 7 gold, 2 silver, and 3 bronze medals, and the United States with 6 each of gold, silver, and bronze. Until this year's edition, Kenya's best outing was a second place overall finish at the 2007 edition of the championships in Osaka, Japan. In the first edition of the championships in Helsinki, Finland in 1983, Kenya did not even appear on the medals table. Altogether, 8 African teams made it to the medals table at the 2015 edition. They are, in the order in which they finished, Kenya, Ethiopia, South Africa, Eritrea, Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco, and Uganda. Congratulations to Kenya, the overall winner of the 2015 World Athletics Championships, for this great achievement. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
This is Larry Zamuje, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9 Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Kenya's seventh and final gold medal in Beijing was won by Asbel Kiprop, who came from behind to win his third consecutive world title in the men's 1500 meters final.
I knew that when it comes the last 200, 250 meters, remember that's how McLaughlin won Olympics in London here in the last 250. I've been looking at his qualifying rounds when he races my colleague here. It's been... They've been running both of them the last 250 meters. But when you compare his last one, last 50 meters, it's not moving. So I was a little bit confident that maybe that's where I could catch them.
That's Asbel Kiprop of Kenya, the three-time world champion in the men's 1500 meters race. And Kiprop was speaking in Beijing, China. Kenya's six other gold medal winners in Beijing were Julius Yago in the men's javelin, David Rudisha in the men's 800 meters race, Nicholas Bett in the men's 400 meters hurdles race, Ezekiel Kemboy in the men's 3000 meters steeplechase race, Hyvin Jepkemoy in the women's 3,000 meters steeplechase race, and Vivian Chariot in the women's 10,000 meters final. Truly a great showing by the Kenyans at the World Athletics Championships.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled One-on-One with Luol Deng, and I reflect on the recent visit to our Voice of America headquarters by the South Sudan-born basketball star. In an interview with the Sunny Side of Sports, the 30-year-old Deng paid tribute to Dikembe Mutombo, who will be officially enshrined in the Basketball Hall of Fame next week.
You know, every time anyone says the name Mutombo, the first thing you do is smile. It's really amazing because he's just, he's been a great example for the continent, a great human being. Been teaching all of us a lot of things, all the young basketball players. And that's, I haven't even spoke about, you know, what he's done on the court, everything that really he stands for. He's done a great job of just showing everyone in the whole wide world who he really is without the basketball. And just like you said, he's that good to be, you know, a Hall of Famer. And that's something that, you know, going to be remembered for a long time.
Do you view him as maybe a role model in terms of your own humanitarian work?
No, of course. Of course. I mean, I can't sit here and say I haven't, you know, seen what he's done or haven't heard about it. And I think all those things affect you. All those positive things makes you, you know, one day want to just do similar things that he's done. And he's just been so great and so active in putting the continent out there, letting everyone know what's going on. And at the same time, spending time and putting people together in order to do something great to help others. So he's definitely a role model.
That South Sudan-born basketball star, Luol Deng of the Miami Heat, speaking at our VOA studios here in Washington. Deng is the subject of my latest Sunny Side of Sports blog post.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Senegal is sending a team to next week's World Wrestling Championships in the western U.S. city of Las Vegas, Nevada. To find out more, reporter Ricky Shryak called the first vice president of the Senegalese National Wrestling Committee, Theano Ka.
The World Championships to be held in Las Vegas starting from September 10. The Senegalese wrestlers will be there.
How many of them will be there?
Altogether, five Senegalese wrestlers.
As I understand it, there are both men and women coming in as Senegalese wrestlers, correct?
Yes.
Can you tell me how many of each?
For men, the Senegalese are three. Female from Senegal, just two.
One of them is Isabel Sambou.
Well, Isabel Sambou will be going. She is currently vice champion on the continent in her category. She participated in the last Olympic Games in London and came out fourth because she missed the bronze medal. And she has been champion for over, I think, eight times in her category of champion of Africa.
So do you guys have high hopes for Isabel for this tournament?
We have, but I should say reasonably. She's not that young and she has the level. We hope she will have good results.
Do you think she's had to face especially hard obstacles getting to this level considering she's a woman?
You're right, because the ladies wrestle only in the south of Senegal. Okay, and that is tradition there. So you cannot have as many competition or tournaments as you would find with male wrestlers, that's clear. So she certainly had to convince her family to let her go her way in wrestling. And she's been doing it for over 10 years now.
In Senegal, the biggest sport is traditional wrestling. Do you think this popularity of traditional wrestling helps Senegal be able to find and develop Olympic wrestlers? And what is the difference between the two sports?
Senegalese wrestling, once one of the opponents or the protagonist falls down, he loses his combat. Olympic wrestling, you wrestle on your feet, can also wrestling on the mat.
That's Theano Ka, the first vice president of the Senegalese National Wrestling Committee, and he spoke from Dakar with reporter Ricky Shryak. Finally, Togo beat host Djibouti Friday 2-0 in a qualifying match for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations football tournament in Gabon. The Sparrowhawks from Togo got first-half goals from Serge Akpo and Jonathan Ayite. Togo now tops Group A in Gabon 2017 qualifying with the maximum 6 points from two matches. Djibouti suffered its second straight loss after being trounced by Tunisia 8-1 in its first qualifier. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a school teacher in Kairuki, Kenya, is the number one crime stopper in town. And next, South Sudan police officers attending workshops to better understand the importance of freedom of speech and protection for journalists. But first, some music. Here is Seweni Anikolpo Kuti of Nigeria with Think Africa. We'll be right back.
Joe. They are not for this kind of leadership for boxers, Joe. We don't they fight themselves every day. Instead, they never beat themselves today, Croatia. Tomorrow, now the president, they beat in fights. Army go beat police. Police go beat civilians. Even before we civilian fight, they don't fight themselves for us on our behalf. I beg.
Sewani Yani Kulpokuti of Nigeria with Think Africa.
A school teacher in Karayuki, Kenya began tweeting to his students and to the community 4 years ago. Now he is the community's chief and the number one crime stopper in town. As Ruben Kayama reports in his interview with the chief, tweeting is up and crime is down.
And if their chicken is lost, they call me chief. My chicken is lost, put it on Twitter, but they don't know what is Twitter. They know Twitter is chief's message. They don't know what is Twitter, but they know. Rather put it on Twitter.
That's Chief Kariuki, popularly known as the Tweeting Chief. He is the local government administrator in charge of Umoja Lanet in Nakuru County. Citizens are impressed by his use of the social media for combating crime in his community. Chief Kariuki boasts, saying that he has been able to reduce theft, carjacking, and burglary.
So when I send a message out, they are either stolen a car or they are breaking to somebody's house. What they do is they run away because they know they have been discovered. We have recovered, carjacked, they just dropped them. Another day they were stealing a transformer here. And people told me, oh, Baraka is the transformer. Is being stolen. I sent a message out and this guy jumped from the top and ran away.
Chief Kariuki, a former teacher for over 20 years, started using Twitter in May 2011 to help make local people aware of crime and other issues. He quit teaching to pursue his newfound passion as a public servant. He felt he could serve more people as a chief than as a teacher.
It's a requirement that every administrator like me or every chief to have 2 public balazas in a month to address different issues. For example, maybe there was an outbreak of polio, or maybe like today we have the free medical camp. So it was getting hard for me to be able to communicate and call people to come for these meetings.
He says that communicating to the locals was a major challenge, and this prompted him to look for an alternative method to relay information to the people of Umoja Lanet.
Luckily, I was able to come across Twitter website and look for tweeting through SMS. From there, life was never the same again.
The tweeting chief says that Twitter has come in handy at a time when he had challenges communicating to the elderly and locals who have little understanding of the social media. He says that one does not need to have a smartphone or internet connection to access his messages. All his people are able to get his messages immediately he sends in any type of mobile phone.
Even the cheapest phone, they don't need to have any sort of internet. It is SMS based. So that's why when I saw how it works, my next thing was that, how do I connect with the citizen? What in Kenya you call mamamboga, those people who do not have any sort of phones, the internet enabled phones or smartphones. So 8988 solved the whole problem. That code, because it converts tweet into text message, and they can also be able to follow me through text message.
For a man who wears many hats, like Chief Kariuki, the work has not been an easy feat. He is not only a man of the people, but also a father and a husband. You might wonder what language the chief uses to send his information to more than 15,000 people, some educated while others are illiterate. Well, this is what he has to say.
And I write the simplest language they can understand. If their chicken is lost, they call me chief. My chicken is lost, put it on Twitter, but they don't know what is Twitter. They know Twitter is chief's message. They don't know what is Twitter.
For Chief Kariuki's admirers, Umoja Lanet is a safe haven thanks to one man's curiosity for technology and passion for public service. Reporting for VOA News, this is Ruben Chama in Nakuru.
Music
20 South Sudan police officers recently attended a Juba workshop designed to help them better understand the importance of freedom of speech and protection for journalists. Nabil Biagio reports on the three-day training, which occurred on the day a newspaper journalist was shot and killed by unknown gunmen.
So far this year, seven have been killed and no suspects have been arrested in any of the cases. International observers believe part of the problem stems from the mistrust and ignorance, especially among officials and public officers, about the role of journalists in society. That's part of why last week's training was organized by the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, known as UNESCO, and the Community Empowerment for Progress Organization, or CEPO. Salah Khalid is South Sudan's UNESCO country representative.
We worked with the South Sudan National Police Service to train the first batch, the first group of police officers with different rankings on the role of police for the safety of the journalists. And the objective of this workshop or this training is basically to raise the awareness of the police officers on the role of the media professionals in general, the role of the journalists in conveying information to the public.
The workshop was also a training for trainers so that participants can now take the information they have learned to train more of their colleagues. Khalid believes their training will greatly benefit both police officers and journalists.
They were trained and made aware of the media laws, for example, which they did not know about. The general international conventions on civil and political rights, freedom of the media and existing the fundamental rights, the state obligations on the safety of journalists, and they were made aware of the UN plan of action to fight impunity in cases of violence against journalists.
The UN plan of action on the safety of journalists and the issue of impunity, which was developed in 2013, targets five countries. South Sudan is one of them. On the first day of the session, newspaper journalist Peter Moy was shot and killed by unknown gunmen. His wallet and cell phone were untouched. Khalid says the tragedy of that incident drove home the importance of the workshop.
I conveyed the message to the police officers that we don't want to see South Sudan falling into this kind of cycle of violence against journalists. Being a new country, this is the opportunity to start on the right track for development. And freedom of expression is an essential right and an essential channel to guarantee the development of a new country like South Sudan.
Khalid says the officers were engaged and very receptive to information about constitutional rights of journalists. Major James Dak was one of those officers.
It was great because we didn't know that the bill of media has been passed by our national constitution body within the assembly, and now it has become into law. We even requested them to give us a copy of that media law.
Dak is Director General at the Department of Training for Human Resource Development at Juba's Buluk Police Unit. He says building a harmonious relationship between his officers and members of the media is not an easy task, but it must be done.
This harmony could be built through awareness. Now, for example, the little information we receive in 3 days workshop, we will inform our cadets as well as our recruits, the function of media, and to tell them that media are also guided by law.
The officers talked about incidents of harassment, arbitrary detention, and even beatings of journalists in South Sudan, and how those incidents should have and could have been avoided. But Dak insists that police officers are not the worst abusers of journalists' rights. He says the dubious distinction lies with South Sudan's national security personnel. At the end of the session, it was unanimously agreed that security personnel must be invited to participate in future workshops on journalists' rights. Tabisa Antipas is one of two female officers who attended the training. She wholeheartedly supported the idea and describes how she plans to utilize what she has learned.
التطبيق بيكون بتبادل بين الطرفين To apply what we have learned, we need to build a good rapport between the media and the police. Journalists have obligation to observe, and we, the police, also have responsibilities. The police must protect journalists and allow them access to information, while journalists should abide by the law.
Participants also recommended that future training sessions be longer and that they cover more topics regarding officers' interactions with journalists. Organizers vowed to line up more workshops that incorporate the officers' recommendations. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Huntley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a further sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on three more leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabaab. The men are Yasin Kilwe, Abdikader Mohammed Abdikader, also known as Ikrima, and Jafar, also known as Ammar. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, has control of large areas of southern and central Somalia and is responsible for the death of thousands of Somali citizens, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Since 2006, Al-Shabaab has engaged in a campaign of violence, including bombings and suicide attacks, which has killed thousands. In July 2010, it planned and executed a bomb attack in Kampala, Uganda, that killed more than 70 people, including an American citizen. Yasin Kilwe is Al-Shabaab's leader in the Puntland region of Somalia. He pledged his allegiance to Al-Qaeda in February 2012. Abdikader, 34 years old, was born in Kenya of Somali parents. He has coordinated recruitment of Kenyan youth into Al-Shabaab and commanded a force of Kenyan fighters operating in Somalia. He reportedly has medium-length hair, a thick mustache, and is missing three fingers on his left hand. Jafar has served as Abdikader's deputy and reportedly is missing one eye. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy. Submit a tip through the RFJ website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. The United States guarantees that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the United States is prepared to protect informants by relocating them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
The sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.